When I started thinking about what I would read this evening, I started thinking about what poetry is anyway, what it is, what it does, where it goes. And even Marianne Moore said she herself dislikes it. I thought I'd begin this evening by reading some thoughts about just those questions. The first poem on those questions that I thought I would read is not one of mine, but one by a poet I very much admire, Stephen Dobbins. And actually, it was his poem that impelled me to write a poem of my own on this subject, perhaps in response to it. His poem is called Song of Basic Necessities. The day hates you and the wind has stolen the coat from your back. Take this poem. Unfolding it from the page, it becomes a cloak. Now, as you walk through the streets of winter, you listen idly to the talk of the unfaithful, how you must have flattered the sun for it to give you a ray to wrap around you. You are hungry and haven't eaten for days. The food of the world becomes ash in your mouth. Take this poem. Now it is a banquet, wine, fish, freshly baked bread. You invite your friends to a clearing by the river. Just as you fear there won't be enough, more food appears, and the glasses refill themselves like the feast in another story. You are lost and without shelter. People avoid you. Storms seek you out. Take this poem. It is a tent to put around you. Warm within it, you prepare for sleep, while in the rushing of the wind, you hear the voices of your friends. They speak of their love for you. They hope tomorrow you will come home. That's Stephen Dobbins' poem. My poem is called This Poem. If you are cold, this poem will not warm you. If you are hungry, you will not be fed by this poem. If you are sick, it will not cure you. If you are alone, the poem won't take your hand. This poem lives in warm houses. It has never known hunger. All it can do is, from a pocket of loose change, select a coin to drop into your palm, the cold coin of compassion in this poem. But then, on a more optimistic note, I wrote, on rereading the poets, thinking about the mad poets, the drunken, the drugged, the dead poets, the forgotten ones, the ones half remembered for badly remembered lines, misunderstood, admired for the wrong reasons and too late, I am amazed at the persistence of poetry. Like the secret writing of children that becomes visible on paper held over a flame, obstinately, the old lines come to life, letter by letter, stuttering across the page, confounding criticism, fanned into breath over and over, making themselves new again. It was ideas of that sort, I guess, that produced the rest of the poems that I'm going to read this evening. The next one is called Traveling Without a Camera. Imagine traveling without a camera. How difficult it is trying to remember precisely the pattern stamped on the toothy ridges at Real de Catorce against an apricot sky, or the look of the mountainside as night overtakes it, reclaims it, and salts it with stars, which after all are not stars, but the lamps of home to strangers you never saw and will never meet, or to conjure up to what they call the mind's eye the exact configuration of this wall, weathered and crumbling, into which a lizard mysteriously vanishes. Isn't this the way you travel through childhood, retaining only certain images that at first seem clear and real as this morning, until you peer more closely and they disappear? Deceitful memory fades and dissolves in all around I see, as if an inept cameraman were to film ineptly for a thousand days and leave a dark room filled with damaged prints. This is, I suppose, these poems that I'm reading at first are part of a group of poems that have to do with traveling, with going away and coming back. The next one is called Ways of Returning. Returning through the back streets, through alleys so narrow the walls of the houses part like grass, leaning backward, their patience demonstrated by scarred plaster, worm-eaten sills, and thrust through a chalk-blue door, a clenched brass fist. Everything the same as it was, the sun, boys shooting marbles, the same flies buzzing minarets of garbage, the same fists, or skating across the enormous mirrored spaces of an airport in St. Louis or anywhere, passing the snack bars, the budget rent-a-car, electronic games, seeing the men and women queued up to telephone to say to someone, to anyone at the end of the line, hello, it's me, I'm back, or after driving all day long to come into town at nightfall, the avenues festooned with lights, every block so familiar, you catch a glimpse of yourself coming down the street, yourself in a coat you wore then, carrying something you carried then, or maybe are carrying still. Visiting the ruins. There are ruins everywhere, both the old romantic kind thrusting up out of a mist-shrouded German lake, or those heaps of glass and rubble in Beirut, garbage rotting on the avenues of Manhattan that don't stand for anything. 100 years from now, they will all be one with the buried cities of Troy, the way nobody now remembers the war in Spain, and in the book of compassion and despair, nothing remains but scenes of sorrow and joy commemorated like historic sites. So something's to be said for staying home and reading Apollinaire in St. Louis, for translating Baudelaire in Iowa City, and looking for Rabelais in secondhand bookshops below 14th Street without putting a moi in every landscape. The next poem is called The Salt Museum, and it was started when I came across a poster from a chapel which is actually in a salt cave somewhere in Latin America. the idea of building a chapel inside a cave where they were mining for salt fascinated me, and I wrote the Salt Museum. In the Salt Museum, every sculpture, every carved artifact, from the massive heads and torsos of giants and giantesses to antique pieces of furniture and the most delicate filigrees, even fabrics as fine as cobwebs, is confected of salt. Here come the visitors, weeping, wives without husbands, children crying for their mothers, lovers left lonely, to water with their tears the displays in the Salt Museum. Each glistening teardrop evaporated in the museum's dry air deposits an infinitesimal film on the masterpieces in the galleries of salt. The Game of Troy. You want to smash the pattern of every day, the dailiness of it, the waking with sticky eyelids, feet finding the floor, the toothbrush finding the teeth, cold water, then warmer, in the inevitable shower you don't even remember stepping into, shirt, socks, and so on, stairs and the cat in or out, the same thing every day, the same sun glinting on fenders and chrome of Fords and Toyotas all over the city, people rushing to work with ham sandwiches Monday to Friday and weekends at the lake. Do you think it was different in an age of heroes, that every day had its dragon? Even on the plain of Troy, Achilles sulked in his tent, and after the fighting was over, Helen would probably have been glad to go back and be a common housewife. As for Odysseus, that cunning dawdler, he invented his own adventures, or Homer did, telling tall tales, taking the long way home. Some of these poems are based on true occurrences. And it is true that I work as a military intelligence research analyst also. This poem is called The Apparition. When the head of Jesus appeared on the bathroom door, nobody wanted to believe it, but there it was, gradually developing like a bad negative, those flowing locks, those deep, compassionate eyes darkening on the plain wood of the door where nothing but the grain of the cheap pine had been visible before. This happened in an ordinary house built about 80 years ago by a man who built several others in the neighborhood. All of them are still lived in, but of course there have been changes, although in none had any kind of apparition ever been seen before. Since no one reported it, nobody came to kiss it or chip holy splinters off the door or wait for it to weep miraculous tears and cure cancer or reverse a fatal course. In any case, it would have been too late to save my friend who died suddenly last year, not having been ill before. The next poem is called Mrs. Mandrell and the Water Table. I wrote this poem in a dry year. I think this year we don't have to worry about a lack of water in the water table. Mrs. Mandrell and the Water Table. On the day the well ran dry, Mrs. Mandrell bathed in soda water, icy and scentless as the mountain spring where it erupted and was bottled, then trucked to her where she lay. Did its barrage of bubbles prickle against her skin? Did she fizz all over like imported champagne? Did her body become strange to her, suspended in Perrier water? Luminous in crystal, her body is immortal in 1,000 museums and galleries, but Mrs. Mandrell is not a renewable resource. Being writ on water, ambiguous element from which life springs, when all the wells run dry, with what shall she be watered? Pete and the Drunkards. If he had boarded the bus with its cracked seats of imitation leather, keeping in his hand the flimsy ticket for which he had paid 85 cents American, that ticket with its meaningless, mysterious numbers, couldn't Pete have stepped off into this dusty square with its 6 withered trees and 8 benches? Couldn't he have walked up this alley and rented a room in one of these small houses where he could unpack his satchel on the thin mattress and leave his book on the wooden table? Then, under Mexican trees rattling in the wind, distraught, waving their wild green arms, he would have found his way to a lighted doorway and reeled with the drunkards down passages of stars, adrift in the Milky Way, 3,000 miles from home. These first poems that I'm reading are from my last book, or I guess I should say my most recent book, which this one is called Robert's Knee, and it too is a true story. Robert, who more than anyone abhors superstition and things that can't be explained, in Manila consulted a psychic surgeon for his knee. It was in the interest of science. The house was far out in the suburbs, a long ride in a rattletrap taxi with doors wired to close like the ones kidnappers use, and upholstery cracked open to ooze an ambiguous stuffing. I imagine a house of painted pink stucco. I imagine a weedy yard with a rusty gate. I imagine a small, hot room. A single naked bulb sways on a cord above the table. I imagine a woman in a sweaty flowered dress, welcoming, wearing gold-rimmed glasses. The surgeon enters. He is a cousin of the taxi driver, small, serious, in a business suit. He washes his hands at the sink as the woman positions Robert on the table. I cannot imagine what will happen next. It takes a long time. Robert's knee has been examined by doctors in Denver, St. Louis, and Washington, D.C. They have attacked it with scalpels and forceps. They have manipulated it with trained fingers. They have introduced through a microscopic incision the most advanced instruments and prescribed a regimen using pulleys and weights. Now the surgeon is rubbing his hands over Robert's knee. It glistens with oil and salve, but Robert can't see it. Where he lies, he can only watch the woman as she right now touches a match to a single stick of incense, and into the corners of the room creeps a thin, blue, pungent thread. There is no pain in the knee or anywhere, when suddenly the surgeon raises with a grunt a bloody hand squeezing something that oozes, something like blood or sand, and displays it to Robert before he flings it, splat, into a basin. That's it then. I imagine Robert sitting up to examine his knee. It looks the same. There is no incision. The surgeon does not cut. Since flesh is grass, it moves aside to let him reach within and pluck out what offends. He's pleased, washing his hands. The woman takes the money. Next morning, Robert wonders if he feels a brief returning twinge. He can't be sure. I suppose you all know who Frida Kahlo was, the Mexican painter who was married to Diego Rivera. She had originally intended to go to medical school, but one day when she was on her way to the university, she was in a dreadful accident that left her impaled on a steel rod, and for the rest of her life, she was in pain all the time. She painted many paintings, most of which were self-portraits in one version or another. This poem is called Frida and I. Walking into my life one morning on Riverside Drive, with no idea of what to expect. How could I have foreseen maguey with tall stalks like giant asparagus exploded at the tip into bonsai shapes like the windswept pines of Northern California? Or these seminal pigments, crude primary yellows, magenta of bougainvillea, scarlet and vermilion, acidic, olive greens, puke greens, pinks, purples, green bronze, nut brown, cinnamon, that exhale an acrid smoke into the thin blue air. In a black doorway, a girl teeters on spike heels, waiting for her life. She can't imagine how it will arrange itself, or what it will offer her. Frida never saw the accident that created her, changing her in an instant that never ended into art. Below the scaffold where Rivera painted, she came with her basket, folklorico, or lay immured in plaster, her screams translated into paint, Frida after Frida, a procession whose heroine was death, the little aunt of the little girls. Death is no stranger in Mexico. Whether in the blue house on Laundress Street, or in the square near the university, or in the room never mentioned behind the police station. Even in New York, it followed her through the open window of Hampshire House, three giant steps down to the sidewalk as she painted it. In Paris, she had appetite for the food, but none for the French, and returned inevitably to the land of the prickly pear spiny fruit of Mexico in a parade of self-portraits. They bleed not only for Frida, but for all she knew, sisters and brothers pierced by the thorns of history, struggling in violent times to make a life. Every poem is a self-portrait. I thought I would close with some new poems that have not been in any book. Have come out of summers spent not in St. Louis, but in other places. The first one is called Landmarks. Driving down the road in the lee of the East Mountain, where only a few weeks ago a bear came questing for food, or maybe only out of simple curiosity, they are looking for familiar landmarks, the expected turn down toward a bridge into the pass. In mud time, there was no way to ford that hollow. Tom Hall left his pickup on the far side, and the kids climbed up the fields and rode with him to school. Here, four old apple trees bore wormy fruit. Forget the traveling, the tedious highways, the lugubrious nights in second-rate motels where a single bulb makes shadows swoop and flicker. Forget the cities of the middle border repeating their long-winded stories of Indian fighters, their brash commission men invading the wilderness with valises of civilization and fire water. Here on the ridge, the continent thrusts up through the forest cover, a bare, bony rib out of primordial time, older than Eden. High on the mountain, that rocky sign still points a homeward direction, even if all the names are down and plantings of trees and houses along the old road turn it new and strange. The title of this poem comes from an article in the Bennington, Vermont Banner. Vermont's oldest citizen turns 110. To the mouth of the Sibyl's cave, to the steamy cleft in the rock, to the heart of the labyrinth, once they came, suppliants, rewarded only by moans or bat-like squeaks or grunts translated into riddles that echoed amid the stones. Today, a celebration. Here comes a small parade of men in important suits. The governor leads the way. Their heels click on the floor as they approach. She waits, although she does not know what they are coming for. Propped in her chair, she peers blindly at looming faces. What have they come to learn from her who can tell them nothing from her more than 100 years? Nothing's important, she says. It is not what they came to hear. The riddle remains obscure. Transcendence. Somewhere out there, someone is tapping, knocking at the doors of the trees that won't open, trying to peer into their windows. This morning I heard him fumbling at the keyholes of the rocks, trying to force them to give up their secrets. This is no Eden, this little clearing in the shrubby woods. The bed of the dry water hole is cracked like permafrost. In the Book of Knowledge, I read of a people who fasten their prayers on trees for the wind to read and carry up to heaven. Already, the leaves are starting to publish their flamboyant farewells, poems that need no interpreting. This last poem is called Into the Trees, and it's dedicated to Don Finkel, who used to disappear every morning into the trees. One, he's disappeared now into the familiar trees, as if birch, balsam, sumac, maple are his familiars. Under the cloud-speckled sky, the clover-speckled grass, deep pools of shadow under the trees, he's gone now into the trees. How he envies them their long, secret lives, the dark roots delving into the earth, the dark trunks and branches reaching up toward the sky, even the pathos of leaves in their manifold, tender shapes, wondering if they feel pain like us. When they switch their green skirts in the wind or hunch dripping shoulders under the rain, are they sorry or glad? Do they know what it is to be a tree? They are whispering now, leaf to leaf. They are bowing and curtsying in the green shadows, and he is coming out slowly through the green corridors, stepping carefully through thickets of sumac, honeysuckle, thorny blackcaps, thrusting aside their clinging arms, releasing their heady aromas like souls soaring heavenward from under his heavy, reluctant boots. Part two. The sun's come out again after a day of rain and then another cloudy day, and he's out there again conversing with the mullein that's grown as tall as he is overnight. Now every day he's out there taking notes. Down by the pond, loosestrife and Queen Anne's lace, under the willow, speedwell and wood sorrel. He's working to decode their secret languages, pushing aside the heavy drapery of leaves and thorny branches interlaced. No passage is too daunting. He'll translate those green inscriptions, even eavesdrop on the wind that takes their wordless messages, hoping that one day they will speak to him, trusting that one day he will understand. And to conclude, I'm going back to call the long, well, this poem is called Calling the Nine Proud Walkers. There is no longer anyone who listens. The voices are too insistent. There are too many clamoring to be heard, too many shouting, crying out, howling, bawling, and bellowing, too many mutterers, mumblers, stammerers, ranters and declaimers, tub thumpers, spouters, incoherent babblers, gibberers, jabberers. The wires are buzzing like an angry hive. The airwaves, overloaded, can't transmit anymore. Silent, solitary in the starless night, I am besieged by invisible regiments, the clamorous armies of the have-nothings. Where are the nine proud walkers who might have smoothed this discord into song?